Please note that the opinions and perspectives shared on the Real Pharma podcast by Nari O and Ian Wendt are their own. These views do not represent the positions, strategies, or opinions of their employers or any other organizations with which they may be affiliated. Now on with the show.
It seems like a lot of what happens in healthcare is often, hey, you're not getting pregnant. Let's figure out the quickest way to help achieve a pregnancy, which very well for some people might be a surgical-based solution. But we are saying, hey, you're not getting pregnant. Maybe there's some other things going on that really we want to address and treat for, because that will not only help you conceive, but then helps you throughout your pregnancy and beyond.
This is Real Pharma, your podcast for real conversations with pharma pathfinders. In every episode, you will hear from an industry insider who has a story to share that goes beyond the headlines. No spin, no sacred cows, no hidden agendas, just stories and the people behind them. Now, here are your hosts, Dr. Nari O and Ian Wendt.
Welcome to another episode of the Real Pharma Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Wendt, joined by the ever knowledgeable Dr. Nari O. Hi, Nari.
Hello.
And today we have a special guest who's transforming the world of female fertility, Shelley Bailey, the founder and CEO of Family Fertility, and that's Family, F-A-M-L-E-E. Shelley's journey into the fertility space is as unique as it is inspiring. Before founding Family, Shelley and her partner owned a specialty pharmacy, which focused on serving individuals with HIV and hepatitis C. Her transition from pharmacy to fertility was sparked by her personal experiences and challenges in starting her own family. Shelley's drive and dedication led her to create Family, a comprehensive step therapy, home-based fertility testing, and clinical treatment solution. So this solution is designed to empower women to balance their hormones, improve their fertility, and really take control of their health journey, especially when preparing for pregnancy. Shelley also serves as a McKesson National Independent Advisory Board member and holds memberships on a variety of state and federal pharmacy work groups, including being vice chair of the Oregon Drug Affordability Board. She's also an advisor to companies including InvinceMed and AirX Health. Shelley's story is a testament to her resilience and commitment to making a difference in women's health. So join us as we delve into her fascinating journey from pharmacy to fertility and learn how Family is helping women navigate the complex world of fertility with ease and confidence. Shelley, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Ian and Nari. I'm happy to be here.
Welcome indeed. I'm so excited that you're on the show today, Shelley, and look forward to hearing more about your personal and professional journey in this really interesting field. And I just wanted to start with a story that struck me a few years ago, which was about Brigitte Nielsen of Rocky IV fame, who at 54 years old had her fifth child, a first daughter, after four sons that were born much earlier. And she had tried IVF for 13 years without success. And I think this topic is very mainstream. I know a lot of women who've tried for many years to have children. It's a very common topic of discussion, not really as stigmatized as it used to be in the past. And I think the stats also are quite impressive. So women generally have children later all around the world. In the US, the average age at first birth is 27.3 years in 2021. That's up almost 2 years from a decade before. In Europe, the average age is even higher, 29.4 years in 2019. And when we go to Asia, it's even higher. And actually, the oldest average age worldwide, as per the United Nations, was Hong Kong with 32.8 and South Korea with 32.5. South Korea also has the lowest fertility rate in the world. In 2022, it was 0.78 children per woman. And also the highest gender pay gap of all OECD countries. And maybe we can talk about that more later. But then women also have fewer children. Globally, it is 2.3 children per woman in 2021. And that's down from about five children in the 1950s to 1970s. And there are many factors that contribute this. And I'm hoping that you can also shed some light on that. But let's move on to your really fascinating journey. Can you talk to us a little bit more about your journey and your inspiration behind why you started Family and how your personal and your professional life really kind of intersected here.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for that background information you shared. You brought up some really interesting key points that, you know, I'd be happy to continue to discuss. But related to me, I never thought I would be an entrepreneur in the digital health, you know, space related to fertility. Honestly, growing up, I was taught so little about like female reproductive health that even just kind of starting my own personal journey, there was a lot of education that I had to really focus on to conceive. But essentially, as Ian had shared previously, you know, I spent 20 years in pharmacy and for 10 of it, you know, in specialty pharmacy. So when we sold in 2018, I really thought, hey, I'm going to take a breather from working outside the home. I had a 5-year non-compete. So that led to that in part. But my kind of next path really was that I wanted to be a mother. And I guess I'm a type A personality kind of person. And so I just never thought I would have trouble conceiving. I just was like, hey, I'm doing pharmacy and now my next to do is I'm going to be a mother and, you know, I'm going to kill that and do a phenomenal job. And so when I wasn't conceiving, you know, it was something that was just really shocking. So my own journey was I started, you know, doing kind of what is really the standard path for fertility care and treatment right now. I went to my OB-GYN. I waited like 5 months for my first visit related to getting support for fertility. And she basically just looked at me and was like, Shelly, you meet the clinical definition of infertile, which was for women over 35 trying to conceive for over 6 months. She's like, you meet the clinical definition. I'm not a fertility expert. And I really just think for you to get the best care and treatment, you need to go to IVF. And I'm not, nor is Family in any way, shape, or form an anti-IVF solution. But I was just like, wow, I'm coming to you for, you know, what I thought was just a little bit of support. And you're kind of pushing me to the most invasive, inexpensive intervention out there. And that was really just extremely eye-opening. So my own journey was, I was like, wow, let's kind of try to get to the root cause of why I'm not getting pregnant. So I went on my own health journey and really kind of started working with more functional medicine providers. But ultimately for me, my hormones were just a little bit off because I'd worked 100-hour weeks for, you know, over a decade. And so once I conceived using just low-cost generic medications to help better balance my hormones, and once I started supporting my girlfriends kind of informally related, you know, to the same path, I was like, wow, I think we're really onto something that's really missed right now in the fertility space, which is really this step therapy. Hey, let's try something that's cheap and easy before we go to more invasive solutions. So that's really where Family was formed. And in part, just borrowing from my pharmacy background, we're all used to step therapy for expensive drugs, right? Most of the time, people have to try something that's more affordable for payers and the consumers before they go to the more expensive interventions. And that's really the unique niche that I found for Family. And that's really why I launched it. The other really like eye-opening piece once I started building out what is our current product on the market was, you know, like you, Nari and Ian, I come from HIV and hepatitis C and public health, where there's really this focus on testing and treatment, right? You don't do one or the other. It's not only unethical, it's also illegal to test someone without treating. And I really found early in my career, this fertility journey, that there's a plethora of like at-home lab companies. You know, that's easy to do, to test people. It's linking that treatment part that specifically in the reproductive health space just really wasn't there when we got started. So, you know, a lot of girlfriends of mine bought at-home labs. I bought at-home labs myself. And you get information and then you take that report to your OB-GYN and they're like, ah, well, you know, we think you look okay or, you know, something. And so really that kind of a home-based step therapy solution, but also just borrowing from public health, test and treat. You know, honestly, I think it's a little unethical that we give people, you know, these fertility results sometimes without linking care and really requiring care. So that's part of when I went to build our current generation of our product was really making sure you get tested. But treatment is what we focus on.
And so it sounds to me like you're kind of filling a potential gap, I guess, in available treatment modalities, where instead of your experience, where you go from maybe I have a problem right to the end of, okay, IVF is the next step for you. I think your argument is that there might be one or more steps that take place between kind of those two points. So family seems to fill that. Just go a little bit deeper on where family and your, the solutions you provide fit and what other alternatives might exist in that same space prior to exploring IVF as an option.
Absolutely. So, I mean, in a perfect world, family wouldn't exist at all. In a perfect world, everyone would be able to get the care and treatment we provide from their primary care provider or OB-GYN, right? But what we find is access is limited for various reasons. Some of it is socioeconomic, right? People can't miss work to go to their OB-GYN. Some of it's just simply the challenges with staffing, which was the reason why I couldn't get an OB-GYN, just because they didn't have enough. So what we do at Family is we do home-based labs and telehealth treatment that results in the prescribing of prescription medications to help support someone before IVF. So we prescribe the types of drugs that a lot of people would be, you know, common for them, drugs to help support ovulation and things. But we also really do take a functional medicine-based approach, which is, hey, we know that your hormones are off, but why are they off? You know, do you have insulin resistance? Do you have an autoimmune condition? Do you have low vitamin D? Do you have low thyroid? We're really trying to get more to the root cause of why your body isn't able to A, either conceive at all, or B, isn't able to maintain a pregnancy. So we really have a packaged integrated system that provides all of those services to an individual before they go down any other kind of path in their fertility journey. Related to kind of what we do versus what competitors do, there's a lot of companies in the fertility space right now. Obviously, some of the big ones are really focused on negotiating networks and, you know, reduced prices for reproductive care and treatment, IVF and things. And that's kind of more the brick and mortar type of approach for IVF, like IVF PBMs, essentially, that are out there. And then there's companies in the digital health space that I would say, when you really look into their proposals and contracts, which of course we all have access to each other's proposals and contracts at some stage in the journey, really act much more as a hub, where they're able to use coaches and navigators and things to help someone get started and then triage them to medical providers that are part of their medical benefit, but they're not actually providing a care and treatment. Where it gets complicated is most employers, even the heads of total rewards and things at a lot of large companies, don't always understand what they're buying. So sometimes they buy a digital health company in the women's health space or something, and they really think for what they're paying, they're really getting full service care and treatment, where in fact, what they're getting is hub services, which has value, but there's still a great expense on the medical benefit for anything that gets triaged to care and treatment. So our unique value prop, which may or may not be successful at disseminating this, is that when you work with us, you are getting that packaged and integrated care and treatment. We're not triaging until someone's kind of went through our system. We're not immediately triaging out for other medical support. When someone works with us, they are getting their labs, they are getting their treatment visits, they are getting their prescribing of medications, so that we're really improving access and reducing the time it takes for a woman to get care and treatment. So like many women that work with us, someone said, how long is it before I see a doctor? And our customer service team was, hey, once your lab results are available, because we don't even have appointment one until your lab results are available, because we want to make sure we're using everyone's time as wisely as possible. You know, the answer is you can see a doctor in 72 hours. That's not just a random telehealth doctor, but it's a doctor experienced in fertility care and treatment that during that appointment is prescribing you a drug that you can get started on that day. So we're taking months off of the fertility journey by getting people nearly immediate care and treatment to get started.
So how should we think about family? I mean, how would we categorize the organization? Are you a digital health tech company? Are you a telehealth company? Are you a concierge fertility kind of full services? Do any of those labels apply?
I tell people that, you know, we're a step therapy digital health treatment company.
Thank you. That's really amazing. And it jumps out at me just to touch on a couple more stats that Nari and I were kind of discussing, things that I certainly wasn't aware of, that 2% of all babies born in the US in 2019 were born through some form of assisted reproductive technology. And by 2021, that had actually grown to 2.4%, so 20% increase over a two-year period. It looks like about 33% of women undergoing IVF get pregnant during their first cycle, 54 to 77% by their eighth cycle. So that's a lot of interventions. And hopefully you're offering a solution that might prevent all those repeated IVF cycles, which, you know, are costly and are invasive, as we've said, and probably take an emotional toll as well.
Shelley, you said something that struck me at the very beginning. So you were really dedicated to your career, working long hours. And then at some point you decided it's time for me to start a family. And so that's what's going to happen. And it sounded like there was a little bit of a shock for you that didn't go according to plan. And I think that's a very common experience. And so another stat that I also found a little bit shocking when we did the research for this podcast episode, when you're under 30, for each natural cycle, you have about a 1 in 4 chance of getting pregnant, 25%. But when you're about 40, that drops to 5%. So obviously, we all kind of know that in the back of our heads, fertility goes down as you age. But as women who are kind of also culturally trained to believe that we can have everything we want whenever we want, it's a common issue that we all think, I will start a family when it fits with my schedule and with my plans. And we are trying to juggle our family and our career and many other obligations. Can you tell us a little bit more about other common myths or misconceptions about female and maybe male fertility that people have and that really impact this journey, maybe for you personally or in your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, but to your kind of initial point, yeah, I was very angry when I wasn't getting pregnant because, again, I just expected, hey, I've succeeded in different parts of my career journey. I feel like I did all the right things with nutrition and exercise. And I was very shocked and angry that I wasn't getting pregnant. A lot of women spend a whole lot of their life trying not to get pregnant. Society kind of, when you're younger, talks about how easy it is to get pregnant and things. But the reality is there's very few days of the month you can't get pregnant. And to Ian's point about age has a, you know, exceptionally meaningful piece of the fertility journey. But Nari, the other thing you did mention is male factor. And so even in the beginning, when you were kind of talking about your friends that have pursued IVF or weren't getting pregnant, with family, we do have partnerships for male factor treatment because male factor is 30% of infertility issues. But when we, at least I think in the US and often even globally, when we think of fertility, we definitely think of it as a women's health problem, right?
Absolutely. And there's an element of guilt or shame or blame associated with that, right?
A gal in my book club who's in her 60s told me that her first marriage ended because she could not conceive. Her point is now after meeting me, she's like, wow, maybe it wasn't even her, right? It could have been male factor, but truly her marriage ended because of that.
I think in many countries, that's a legitimate reason for a man to get divorced from his wife, if that woman can't bear children.
Absolutely. And so when you think of almost like back to, again, my previous career or the industries I was in, like when you think of discrimination and you think of advocacy and access, I was even reading, so 21 states do have some sort of laws related to requiring payers to have some level of reproductive care and treatment requirements. But even reading, honestly, I'll just call them out because the state I live in, reading Oregon's laws, we have laws to protect access related to terminating pregnancies, but we don't have laws related to providing access and affordable solutions for people who are trying to conceive. And so when I reflect on either previous episodes of your podcast or just my life and advocacy and awareness, it's really sad that A, the discrimination that exists, which was saying it's a women's health problem, right? Obviously, it's a women's health concern, but there's a huge male component But then there's the discrimination related to payer access. And I know that was definitely a tangent from your original question you proposed, but it is something I certainly spend a great deal of my time on.
No, I don't even think it's a tangent at all, Shelley, because this is such a complicated topic and it really is not just about fertility per se. I mean, you mentioned this even for your own story. Your hormones were out of balance. You were working really hard. The stress levels probably were also a contributing factor. But oftentimes, it seems like we're not looking at this holistically.
Absolutely. I mean, I'll disclose this. When I was building out family for the original iteration, I was really focused on a BHRT kind of more solution, you know, with bioidenticals. Obviously, coming from pharmacy and wanting to lean into FDA approved drugs, right? We definitely have a drug based solution. But more than that, we have a functional medicine based solution. So, and I don't mean functional medicine from the perspective of, you know, some listeners might think that's a little bit woo woo, but we write for FDA approved drugs, but we're really focused on what is going on with your adrenals that was related to stress that is impacting, you know, why you're not conceiving? What are all the other factors in your life? And to your point, Nari, stress is what really impacts our hormones, right? But COVID-19, those that have had COVID-19 have impact on their reproductive health hormones too, which is probably a totally different discussion for us to have. But it seems like a lot of what happens in healthcare is often, hey, you're not getting pregnant. Let's figure out the quickest way to help achieve a pregnancy, which very well for some people might be a surgical-based solution. But we are saying, hey, you're not getting pregnant. Maybe there's some other things going on that really we want to address and treat for, because that will not only help you conceive, but then helps you throughout your pregnancy and beyond. We don't have enough data yet to really, you know, go out on the data to go out and make some of these claims, but for women that have had high A1Cs and we've been able to help bring their A1C down, they not only are getting pregnant, they're going to be through their pregnancy journey, they're going to have a healthier pregnancy, right? And then what is that long-term, or someone with a low thyroid? Low thyroid has meaningful impacts on brain development in children, right? So like the fact that we're helping people get pregnant is clearly wonderful. But, you know, our underlying kind of goal is to also help women become healthier that supports future generations.
So building on that, I would love for you to walk through a little bit what would happen if I just said, okay, family, here I am. I'm having a problem with not being able to get pregnant. What is the journey? But how do you incorporate then these other aspects of a woman's life and maybe also her partner's life or the family's life? Because again, you're providing a much more holistic approach to not only focus on getting pregnant as quickly as possible, but also making sure that other factors that have contributed to not being able to get pregnant, but may also contribute to setting up this family for success with having the best environment for the woman, her partner, and the baby. There's so much in there. So maybe I'll go back to my question of what's the journey? So I come to you and say, I need some help. What can you do for me? How would that work?
I'm going to reverse it. I'm going to answer your big question first, and then I'll share the journey. So related to how do we pull in all these factors that contribute and lead up to pregnancy, I'll share where we are essentially versus, I guess, where we want to be. But the first thing that we do is we do an exceptionally robust clinical intake. So we, to start working with family, the intake for both male and the, you know, male and female partners is really all sorts of lifestyle questions, all sorts of previous medical history questions. We have an area where people can provide previous lab results, previous imaging. We really are asking people to invest on the front end of providing as much information as necessary. Long term, we would like to just be able to license that data through multiple data sources so we have it all before your appointment and we don't have to ask people to spend 30 minutes. But right now, that's kind of the current state. What we then do, and again, I will get to the logistics of what the journey looks like, but what we then get to is we have a clinical management protocol, again, borrowing from what I came from in HIV land, where a lot of doctors don't necessarily immediately know what to do with HIV, right? 20 years ago, they needed a little more clinical guidance. We have a back-end clinical management tool that we take all this information, we synthesize it with this clinical management treatment tool to really provide a guided treatment plan that can both help support our doctors and then can be patient facing for them as well. So the current state is a little more leaning into what the individual and their partner, if they have one, is willing to give us. Longer term, we obviously just want to license all that so that we automatically have it so that it dumps into our clinical treatment tool. And that tool is even a separate discussion, because when we talk about democratizing access and we talk about even with employer benefits, IVF is very much a wealthy person solution. Right now, like again, even if you have a $30,000 lifetime cap and you work at a major employer, you have to be able to take time off of work, right? You have to be able to pay for the medications. There's so many people that even current IVF benefits just don't fit into their economic structure. So our clinical management tool that I'm sharing with you supports our internal telehealth delivery of care. We also are working on licensing and making available for free to OB-GYNs throughout the nation, so that anyone can have access to our fertility protocols when they see their own doctor. Because again, it's very important to me that everyone has access, whether or not they have family as part of a benefit from their employer. Related to the patient journey, the existing patient journey, when someone works with family, essentially they get, you know, communication from their employer that there is a current benefit. They have a secure login that they can access our solution. But we start everything with an initial assessment and the ordering of labs. So sometimes they're async visits, sometimes they're synchronous telehealth visits, but it's essentially to trigger a lab order. So someone starts working with family, they answer some questions, and labs are triggered. They can either walk in and have those labs done, or they can do their labs at home. Once their lab results are available, we reach out to schedule someone's first telehealth appointment. So those appointments are typically scheduled and care delivered within 72 hours of lab results being available. So imagine your first visit with a doctor related to your fertility journey, or at least your first visit with family. We already have the information on your medical background that we need because you provided it. We have your lab results. So the focus of visit one is really to discuss all that, discuss your lab results, and talk about a clinical treatment plan. So for most people, that involves a drug-based plan. Right now, they're typically low-cost generic meds. We also have diet and lifestyle suggestions for people. But what we do is we have the first visit, drugs are prescribed. We like a couple months to pass just to give drugs time to work. And then someone has a follow-up appointment about 3 months later. If we're prescribing thyroid, we order labs during the process so we can dose adjust. Second appointment is much of the same, talk about things, adjust the drugs, and then we like another 90 days to pass and we really kind of round out our solution after that third appointment. I guess the other thing is though, we do live by the motto of if we see something, we say something. So even though we have this like kind of a little more longitudinal care solution, if one of our doctors did see that someone has very low egg count or something, we will clearly provide the care and treatment support that we offer, but we would never. So when we frame family as step therapy, we would still never say, well, you need to go through our system before you access IVF if there was very key markers that would suggest someone needs IVF. So in some use cases, we're a little bit more complementary care, but the intent is always to have us as, you know, step therapy first, unless someone has a known structural or chromosomal abnormality. And when you talk about kind of like warped incentives and the way like the industry is set right now in this fertility specialty, you know, everything's focused on expensive fee-for-service interventions. So can other vendors do what we do? Absolutely. I'm not here to suggest that we've developed some sort of brilliant new clinical solution that no one has thought of before. What we're doing is making it, you know, packaged together and seamless, and ensuring that every single person has done this before they have a more costly and more invasive surgical intervention. So we want patients to feel like if they pursue IVF, that was definitely the path they needed, and they can feel confident that their dollars were well spent. But two, we also want employers to feel that way as well. That, hey, if this individual needs time off and needs a little more flexibility with their IVF journey, that was indeed the best use of those dollars for that individual. And right now, because of the way incentives are structured, our piece often gets missed.
Yeah, I like how you kind of phrase that in terms of packaging and accessibility being so important. Because I think often in the healthcare world, that can be a gap or it's poorly done. And then sometimes that can be the key to a patient really engaging or finding the right care and services or not. And so that's an interesting key differentiator that you called out. And actually, I'd like to focus a little bit more on your entrepreneurial journey, if we could. And Shelley, I was thinking, I believe we met over 20 years ago, time flies. But you know, you always struck me as this person that was so driven, so business-minded. I think that speaks to the 100-hour work weeks maybe that you were doing at that time. And so, you know, I certainly was not surprised to see that you had started this particular venture. But of course, with any startup, there's a tremendous number of challenges that come along with that. And knowing that maybe we have some aspiring founders in our audience, you know, it would really be interesting to hear a little more about that. I understand the why you got into that, but what are some of the key challenges you faced as a founder in building this business? And is there anything in particular in the fertility sector that was of note in terms of those challenges?
Wow, that's a very loaded question. I feel like you're asking me to show everyone my underwear or something. The very first thing that is any sort of words of wisdom is one of my personal struggles is I always want to excel at anything I do. I want to be the best at anything I do. And so I started a company based on my personal story, but I did not start a company based on my area of expertise. So now, obviously, I feel confident about what we have in the market. I feel confident about what we talk about today. But the downside of that was getting to the point we're at was exceptionally costly. Because if you're an entrepreneur, let's say my previous life, if I had started up a company in the pharmacy space, I would have been able to do it with very little capital. I would have felt exceptionally confident, probably overly confident in whatever I was doing. And so it has been a very humbling journey doing family where I truly just had this passion to help people expand their families, right? But I didn't come to this product with a great deal of clinical expertise or, you know, digital health expertise. I came with a whole lot of pharmacy expertise, which isn't particularly helpful with what we're doing right now, right? So I guess there's good. The good in that is my passion has really had to drive it because I didn't have this foundation of these great things I was awesome at that I could like lean into. But the downside is it did cost me a lot more money because I had to rely on hiring the right people to get on the bus that, at least in the beginning of a startup, often entrepreneurs are trying to do themselves. So that's one. But it's also extended my scope and reach and friendship networks far broader than I would have ever imagined, getting me out of my comfort zone, I guess. But it came at a much more significant economic cost than I would have otherwise intended. The other comment to entrepreneurs here would probably be to raise capital as soon as possible, right? They always talk about using other people's money. I came into this endeavor essentially as my second time around in the healthcare space, right? We had a specialty pharmacy that we sold in 2018. So I had a little bit of capital I could use to get us to where we are. But I think that probably negatively impacted the journey where I should have forced myself to raise earlier on. So, and then also I envision family almost exactly as it is when I got started. And I mean, I thought, you know, really Ian and Nari, like, wow, step therapy for fertility, what a no-brainer. I thought I was like the smartest person out there. And I underestimated battling the current structure. And so I wish I had done more due diligence in speaking to the end customer. So people, I think, benefit from our product. They like what we're doing. I probably should have done a lot more due diligence with employers and with brokers and with PBMs. I mean, we're very much leaning into more of a, you know, health plan PBM-based clinical treatment solution, because I think that's where we fit well. But I guess I just thought everyone would see what a great concept this was, just like I saw it. And so I would have achieved our KPIs quicker if I had done more of that due diligence before putting as much money in as we did.
And Shelley, as a physician, I wholeheartedly agree with your step approach. And I can sense the frustration of having to work in an imperfect system with a solution that seems to, as you said, be a no-brainer, and also empowers the people at the center of this, the women who are trying to get pregnant and their partners and their families. But for the future, is there something that you are planning to change? And you don't have to disclose if this is not quite there yet, but having to work within the system with certain rules and limitations, and not compromising the brilliant idea that you have and that you're executing on, are there some tweaks that you are going to make?
Yeah, I think one of the tweaks I'm excited about is seeing the current physician network as partners as opposed to competitors. So we hired essentially pharma market access people, right, when we got started, and we were calling on OB-GYNs and we were saying, hey, let us handle helping people get pregnant, but you keep the patient for OB-GYN male care and treatment and delivery, and isn't this a great win-win? And we went on a wrong path because we had a couple of OB-GYNs really like what we were doing and be willing to refer to us, but we really found that it's too complex of a discussion for a provider to say, hey, I know you have insurance and you can come to me, but I don't really feel confident doing this, so why don't you go to family? It's just not a discussion they're going to have. And so that's where having our clinical treatment protocols kind of embedded into the EMR, I think just will help us strengthen and build our relationships with existing providers that are very much more primary care. But the bigger lofty goal, because we all have to monetize our solutions at some point or they can't be available to people, is the basic foundation that providers could use our protocols for. But then kind of much more broadly, for people, let's say, that don't get pregnant working with their OB-GYN with it, or just the OB-GYN's not as interested, essentially also making our services available more as like a hub service, where we really feel we're expanding the whole reproductive care and treatment pie. If we can get people to have a discussion early on with their primary care or OB-GYN, and then again, if they don't use our protocols or don't want to invest the time as much, then we almost, with patient consent, kind of perform hub services where we can do our clinical treatment, we can do coaching and care navigation, but we also can refer to IVF clinics and things. So really, we really hope that we can be a meaningful impact in getting more people, A, to talk about and get initial support from their primary care and OB-GYN providers earlier. But we really want to expand, you know, globally. In Denmark, they say children born via IVF are 10% of children born, right? So in the U.S., IVF utilization is actually low. So our big lofty goal, in part through our clinical protocols, in part through our home-based treatment, is to really get people having the discussion earlier, get them the support, whether from us or their primary care, and then let our hub services, you know, support these people in whatever use case best fits them, in partnership with pharma, in partnership with providers, so that we're really part of the system and we're not fighting against it. Because right now, I often feel, and we're trying to fight against an existing infrastructure. And that is just something I definitely didn't anticipate getting started with this product.
We feel your pain. I think on the pharma side, as a pharma manufacturer, we're always struggling with access and reimbursement and warped incentive structures, which I'm sure you're quite familiar with, being on the SP space that exists and seems so difficult to change or overcome. And it's frustrating from a business perspective, but it's frustrating too when the system fails patients, right? When cost becomes a barrier to access to medications or services, and in the case of some of what family is offering, those are such challenging things to deal with. And It sounds like you are starting to chip away at that and have some plans to overcome them, but I can certainly sympathize that those are real big mountains to climb.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It in some sick way makes me feel good to know I'm not,
You're not alone.
You're
not alone in your misery on that one. No. So this is a little bit of a two-parter, I suppose. So Shelley, nobody gets anywhere of significance alone. And I wonder if there are any mentors or anybody who you look to for inspiration in kind of the most difficult times, which certainly entrepreneurs have many of those, that have kind of kept you going to get to where you are today. And certainly in terms of all the significant achievements that you have already behind you and those that are coming up. Does anybody come to mind?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I think one of my superpowers probably has always been grit, that I'll just continue to grind something out until I can achieve the outcomes I had intended. And so when I think of, you know, who I might have learned that from, I mean, obviously, I'd say my parents, but also my business partner at the pharmacy. When he started the pharmacy, you know, 40 some years ago, it was a small mom and pop. And he just continued to read about what was going on, listen to what was going. And, you know, together we built it into a nationally accredited SP. And so I would say that my relationship with him and all the learnings over 20 some years of just continuing to pivot, continuing to listen and be open-minded and learn is really what has continued to motivate me when I look at where we are, how we started, and where we want to go.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you for that. And thank you for your time and best of luck as you continue your great work with family. Certainly an area that I was very interested in learning more about. I think I know a little bit more now. And really, I think can be characterized as an innovative approach that meets an unmet need, in my opinion. So thank you for all that work and investing all your blood, sweat, and tears to get this far. I'm really excited to see where you go next, Shelley.
Thank you so much, Shelley, for being on the podcast. It was really inspiring to hear about your story, both personally and professionally. And we're rooting for you.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So what did you think, Ian?
That was a fun conversation, you know, and I was just reflecting, this is actually a little bit of a different episode for us in that we kind of took one company as almost a case study and did a little bit of a deep dive in terms of what they do to reflect what's going on in a particular therapeutic area or a particular area of unmet medical need. It was a fun conversation. Shelley is a force of nature and really respect her as a business person. Love to hear from our listeners if they like that approach. And certainly there's a lot of other interesting companies out there that we could do similar deep dives on if that's something that people like to hear.
Yeah, I loved Shelley's energy and passion, but I also really was impressed with how thoughtful and comprehensive her business proposal is, how it puts the patient or the affected person at the center of the work and gives them alternatives to what they may perceive as the only option they have. And I really like the approach of starting with, what are we even looking at? And maybe there are other issues that need to be addressed before you start with the actual fertility question. And I hope that she finds ways to integrate the solution into the existing healthcare structure, because as she mentioned, it's not always easy to do that because of the way things are set up. But I think the idea is really impressive.
Yeah. And, you know, I think there's certainly patients to be served here. What struck me also was the warped incentive structures and reimbursement landscape that she faces. Somehow we've ended up in a situation where women are being accelerated almost to the end of the available treatment options to IVF, which is invasive and expensive. And our system, let's say, is...
And not easy to go through.
Not easy, right? There's a toll with all of that.
For anybody.
And rather than look at other less expensive, more maybe perhaps more cost-effective, less invasive interventions first, of course, makes intuitively a lot of sense, but the incentive structure doesn't support that. And so women may be steered towards an option that should be a little further down the line, and maybe there's other options that should be considered earlier. And it's frustrating to hear that those aren't reimbursed the way that they should be, arguably.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, we wouldn't start with an MRI if you can start with an ultrasound. It's not a perfect analogy, but there are different steps or options that you can pursue. And it certainly is a little bit disconcerting when you start with the hammer first.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep an eye on Shelley's progress and family fertility as well. We'll link to them certainly in the resources show notes so that if there's anybody out there that wants to find additional information, we'll make it easy for them to do so. But thank you again, Nari. Great discussion. A lot of fun. And look forward to the next episode.
I'll see you then, Ian. Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please visit us at realpharma.co for more valuable resources. Real Pharma is brought to you by Black Canyon Ventures.
And that's a wrap on today's episode of Real Pharma. We hope our dose of pharmaceutical discourse has left you in good spirits and has increased your titers of knowledge.
Absolutely. If you found today's pill-packed adventure as stimulating as a shot of epinephrine, we'd love for you to show us some brand loyalty.
Yes, drop us a like and leave a review. It's the best prescription for podcast success.
Think of your review as the little booster shot that keeps our show in tip-top shape.
And hey, don't just keep us as your secret remedy. Share the good vibes and let others in on our Real Pharma therapeutic sessions.
So hit that review button like it's the perfect cure for a long commute. Your feedback is the treatment that keeps us going.
Thanks for tuning in. And remember, an episode a day keeps the boredom away.
Stay curious, stay healthy, and keep this podcast prescription handy for biopharma stories and insights.
See you next time.
Bye.